Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Peace requires strong mobilization for human rights, sustainable development, and the environment, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said on the International Day of Peace observed on Thursday. People and our planet are in crisis, the UN chief said, highlighting how conflicts continue to drive the vulnerable from their homes while heat waves and floods claim lives and division prevails. This year's Peace Day coincides with the halfway point on the road to the Sustainable Development Goals, and the UN's message is that the promise of the 2030 Agenda to leave no one behind is a key enabler of peace. Amid the high-stakes political encounters underway at the General Assembly and Security Council in New York, the UN chief also called for the use of the timeless tools of diplomacy, dialogue, and collaboration to defuse tensions and end conflict. Peace is not only a noble vision for humanity, peace is a call to action, Mr. Guterres insisted. After almost two decades of negotiations, the first ever international agreement to conserve marine biodiversity and preserve the world's oceans is now open for signatures at the UN General Assembly. The so-called High Seas Treaty was adopted in June when UN Chief Antonio Guterres hailed it as a victory for multilateralism. It was signed by 67 countries on Wednesday, but must still be ratified by each state according to its own procedures. The treaty is a legally binding instrument under the UN Convention of Law of the Sea to address the conservation and sustainable use of marine biological diversity of areas beyond national jurisdiction. These areas cover over two-thirds of the ocean. The High Seas Treaty will come into force 120 days after it's been ratified by a minimum of 60 countries, which could take years. The UN said it hopes that all member states will join the agreement. Violence by Israeli settlers against Palestinians has been steadily increasing across the occupied West Bank, displacing over 1,000 people since last year, according to the UN Humanitarian Affairs Coordination Office, OCHA. OCHA said on Thursday that in the first 8 months of 2023, an average of 3 settler-related incidents affecting Palestinians occurred every day, the highest rate since the UN started recording this data in 2006. In an assessment of the humanitarian needs of 63 Palestinian herding communities in the occupied West Bank conducted last month, the UN found that around 12% of the population have been displaced since 2022, citing settler violence and being prevented access to grazing land by settlers as the primary reasons. Most of those displaced were in the governorates of Ramallah, Nablus, and Hebron, which also have the highest number of Israeli settlement outposts. 4 of the communities have been completely displaced and are now empty, OCHA said. The expansion of settlements into grazing land for livestock, takeovers of land by settlers, destruction of crops, confiscation of land and herds following the declaration of a closed military area, and deliberate pollution of water sources were all cited as issues affecting the lives and livelihoods of Palestinian herder communities. OCHA said that Palestinian herders should be self-reliant based on traditional patterns, but instead, they need humanitarian assistance because of settler violence and the failure of Israeli authorities to hold perpetrators accountable. The ensuing displacement of Palestinians may amount to a forcible transfer, a grave breach of international humanitarian law, humanitarians warned. The UN World Health Organization, WHO, has declared a poliovirus outbreak in Ukraine officially over. WHO said it was a public health success story that Ukraine had managed to stop transmission of the virus that threatened the lives and futures of its children and prevent its spread to other countries, all in the face of the ongoing war. The outbreak was first detected in a young child in Ukraine in October 2021, subsequently linked to a poliovirus episode in Pakistan. WHO said that the comprehensive outbreak response initiated by Ukraine's health ministry faced multiple challenges since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion, including massive population displacement, destruction of healthcare infrastructure, and disruption of logistics routes. The government response, supported by WHO and partners, included contact tracing, disease surveillance, and an accelerated immunization catch-up campaign for children aged 6 months to 6 years who had not received the required doses through routine immunization. The UN Health Agency said that tremendous credit should go to the health professionals and parents who continue to make every effort to vaccinate children on schedule, even while navigating the daily realities and dangers of war. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
And following more headlines provided by Democracy Now!
For radio as secular as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio.
We'll talk about white Christian nationalism.
With our guest, Robert P. Jones, president of PRRI and author of a powerful new book,
The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy's dismissed lawmakers for an extended weekend after a handful of Republican hardliners rebelled and blocked an $886 billion Pentagon spending bill. McCarthy blamed members of his caucus for wanting to burn the whole place down, he said. Their defection makes it increasingly likely the federal government will shut down October 1st when funding for federal agencies expires. On Thursday, Democratic Congressmember Ilhan Omar blasted Republicans for demanding massive cuts to social programs.
Now they launch some of the most radical cuts to health care, to housing assistance, to food assistance, to the postal office, and nearly every program under the sun, all while doing nothing to rein in our nearly $1 trillion Pentagon budget or the trillions they have handed out to millionaires and billionaires through the Trump tax cuts.
Meanwhile, the Pentagon says it'll exempt its Ukraine operations from any government shutdown to allow it to continue training soldiers and shipping arms to Kyiv. We'll have more on the congressional budget fight later in the broadcast with California Congressmember Rohana. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's arrived in Canada after wrapping up a visit to Washington, D.C., where he met Thursday with U.S. lawmakers, military leaders, and President Joe Biden. During a speech at the National Archives, Zelensky thanked the U.S. for the $113 billion in aid to Ukraine approved by Congress, saying the money is helping to prevent a wider war in Europe.
If we fall, half of Europe would again be in danger of being in Moscow's sphere of influence. But American investment in Ukrainian security and global protection of freedom is working 100% every cent.
Meanwhile, Poland's prime minister says he will no longer send new arms to Ukraine and will instead focus on arming Poland with modern weaponry. The move comes amidst a trade dispute that's seen Poland ban imports of Ukrainian grain and other food products. In a historic victory for indigenous communities, Brazil's Supreme Court has blocked efforts led by agribusiness-backed lawmakers to enforce a time limit for making claims to ancestral territory. The case argued indigenous groups were only entitled to land that they physically occupied when the 1988 Brazilian Constitution was signed. Many indigenous communities were expelled from their ancestral territory over the course of decades, including during the military dictatorship. 9 of the 11 justices sided with indigenous people who gathered outside the Supreme Court in Brasilia Thursday in an emotional celebration following news of the ruling. Many wept with joy, others danced.
We're getting emotional. We're happy and we cry because we know that it's only with demarcated territory, with protected indigenous territory, that we'll be able to stop climate change from happening and preserve our biome. We are responsible for it.
In Guatemala, demonstrations have continued nationwide in support of progressive President-elect Bernardo Arevalo and his Semilla political party as prosecutors seek to derail the results of August's runoff election and prevent Arevalo from taking office in January. Protesters are demanding the resignation of corrupt prosecutors backed by Guatemala's right-wing business and political elite who've launched several investigations against Arevalo and Semilla over alleged election fraud and irregularities in the party's registration. International observers have said there's no evidence backing these claims. Arevalo rallied supporters outside the Supreme Court in Guatemala City earlier this week.
Citizenship is exercised not only every 4 years when the vote is cast, but also when the institutions ask us to mobilize to defend democracy. And today, we're here in an act of defense of democracy.
On Tuesday, thousands of indigenous leaders took to the streets of Guatemala, blocking major highways. In New York, Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva warned in his UN General Assembly address about the prospect of a coup unfolding in Guatemala.
In Guatemala, there is a risk of a coup, which would impede the inauguration of the winner of democratic elections.
In immigration news, the Biden administration announced Wednesday it's granting work permits and temporary protection from deportation to nearly 500,000 Venezuelans. Migrants from Venezuela who are already in the U.S. as of July 31st can apply for temporary protected status. The relief will last for 18 months and comes after a massive push led by immigration rights activists demanding work authorization for the tens of thousands of migrants who've arrived at the U.S. in recent months. In related news, a three-year-old migrant child has died after being swept away by the current of the Rio Grande along the Texas border with Mexico. Texas officials also recovered another migrant presumed to have died after drowning in the river. Both bodies were found near the border buoys installed by Republican Texas Governor Greg Abbott to block migrants from crossing into the U.S. Earlier this month, a federal judge ordered Abbott to remove his dangerous floating border barrier. The ruling was temporarily paused after Texas filed an appeal. India has suspended visas for Canadian nationals after Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau Monday claimed the Indian government was involved in the June assassination of a Sikh community leader and a Canadian citizen, Hardeep Singh Nijjar, in British Columbia. India rejected the claim and accused Canada of harboring Sikh separatist terrorists. Both countries have expelled diplomats. The AP's reporting Canada's claim is based on surveillance of Indian diplomats in Canada and intelligence provided by an unnamed ally from the Five Eyes Intelligence Sharing Alliance, which includes the U.S., U.K., Australia, and New Zealand. Billionaire media tycoon Rupert Murdoch announced Thursday he's stepping down as chair of News Corp and Fox Corp and will put his son Lachlan Murdoch in charge. Murdoch's vast media holdings include the right-wing TV network Fox News, which has been plagued by a series of scandals around sexual harassment as well as reporting lies, including around Trump's loss in the 2020 election. We'll have more on Rupert Murdoch's media empire after headlines. In France, police released journalist Ariane Levalieu Thursday, 2 days after her home was raided and she was arrested over her reporting. Writing for the website Disclose, Levalieu reported on a leak that said French intelligence was used by Egyptian forces to target smugglers along the Libya-Egypt border, resulting in the killing of civilians. The reporting says French forces were complicit in at least 19 bombings against smugglers between 2016 and 18. She also wrote about various arms trades in Egypt, Libya, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Russia. Amnesty International Chief Agnès Callamard said, quote, "It is deeply chilling that almost 2 years after the revelations that France was allegedly complicit in extrajudicial executions of hundreds of people in Egypt, it's the journalist who exposed these atrocities that's being targeted rather than those responsible," she said. On Thursday, Levalieu spoke at a news conference at the Paris office of Reporters Without Borders shortly after her release. She deplored the lack of political support for her case and called on parliamentarians to investigate abuses by French intelligence services.
"If all these people remain silent, it is very disquieting for our democracy. If those in power do not ask questions, democracy dies in darkness. As the famous slogan goes, this is a very political, essentially democratic matter."
In Louisiana, a new lawsuit accuses officers in a street crimes unit of the Baton Rouge Police Department of unlawfully arresting people and torturing them in an unmarked warehouse dubbed the Brave Cave. Turnell Brown, a 47-year-old grandmother, says she was arrested at a traffic stop in June after officers falsely told her it was illegal to store her prescription medications in a single bottle. Rather than being processed at the local jail, Brown alleges she was taken to the warehouse where she was stripped naked and subjected to invasive body cavity searches. She was released without charge about 2 hours later. This is the second federal lawsuit against the Baton Rouge police. In another suit, 21-year-old Jeremy Lee, who is black, alleges officers strip-searched him in public before bringing him to the warehouse where he was brutally beaten by officers who turned off their body cameras. Former Trump White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson has accused Rudy Giuliani of groping her on January 6, 2021, shortly before the Capitol insurrection. In her new book, Enough, Hutchinson described Giuliani slipping his hand, quote, under my blazer, then my skirt, unquote, while they were backstage at Trump's speech. A Giuliani spokesperson denied the claim. Meanwhile, the lawyer who'd been leading Giuliani's defense in his litany of legal challenges sued Giuliani for $1.3 million in unpaid fees he owes his law firm. This comes as Georgia election workers Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss said in a court filing Thursday, Giuliani has failed to comply with a federal judge's order to turn over evidence and pay $89,000 in legal fees as part of their defamation case. And in labor news, the United Auto Workers Union says it's escalating its stand-up strike against the big three U.S. automakers today unless significant progress is made at the bargaining table. UAW President Sean Fain will announce the auto plants that will join workers on the picket line at GM, Ford, and Stellantis. Amid soaring profits and CEO compensation, workers are demanding better wages, an end to tiered pay, cost of living adjustments, a return to defined benefit pensions, and a 32-hour work week. Separately, UAW workers in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, have launched a strike at their plant, which produces parts for Mercedes-Benz.
The wages because of inflation right now. The wages that we have is not meeting our needs. And plus, the benefit package they offer us is too high. We can't afford it.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Well, after our Wednesday technical difficulty, in the second hour Wednesday, we were unable to broadcast Maria Gillard's outstanding TUC radio. So we're going to make up for it following Free Thought Radio today in the second hour.
What are they going to say when the Chinese start plucking away American journalists, even though they've never been to China? They're claiming that Julian is under their jurisdiction because he published American secrets, even though he's not an American and he wasn't in America. And at the same time, while they claim jurisdiction over him, they're claiming he has no First Amendment rights because he's an Australian.
Craig Murray on the slow motion execution of Julian Assange on the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
Again, that's in the second hour following this program.
This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Happy Fall Equinox. Saturday, September 23rd at 2 a.m. is the official equinox, and that means we have today and one more full day of summer as this is being recorded. And isn't it nice that this natural event, the autumn equinox, is more or less free of religious appropriation?
And I'm Dan Barker. Annie Laurie and I are co-presidents of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and this is the September 21st, 2023 episode of Free Thought Radio. Grant Blaschka is being helped by Tori in our studio today. They're both with Audio for the Arts. They're engineering in the Stephen Ohl Friendly Atheist Studio in Free Thought Hall, the national office of the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin.
And the Freedom From Religion Foundation is the producer of this weekly program, which is both a broadcast and a podcast. And the Freedom From Religion Foundation works to keep religion out of government, and it also represents those of us who are personally free from religion, and we're about 40,000 current members in North America. If you're one, thank you. If you're not, we'd love to send you complimentary information, a newspaper and brochure about our 45 years of achievements, and we do not sell, loan, share, divulge our mailing list with anyone. So we keep your information confidential, and you can go to ffrf.org to request info, or you can go to the join link at our homepage and join us.
Today, we're going to talk about white Christian supremacy. Our distinguished guest in the second half of the show will be Robert P. Jones. He's the founder and president of PRRI, Public Religion Research Institute, whose surveys on religion and social views we often cite. His powerful new book is called The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy.
Yes, and it's a very important book. And he'll be speaking at our national convention October 13th and 14th in Madison, Wisconsin. We're excited to be announcing in a few minutes 4 significant state church victories this week.
This week is the anniversary of the birth of George Gershwin, the composer of so many songs from the Great American Songbook, as well as serious orchestral music. He was born September 26, 1898. George and his lyricist brother Ira were of Jewish heritage, but they were non-believing and non-observant. Today, during breaks, we will hear some Gershwin music, including Our Love is Here to Stay, Summertime, Bess, You Is My Woman from Porgy and Bess, and Rhapsody in Blue.
And this week on FFRS Ask an Atheist Facebook Live program, FFRF Senior Counsel Patrick Elliott and Staff Attorney Chris Line talked about the growing problem, or the continuing problem, of public school sports and religion being united, especially a recent Christian event at Auburn University called Unite Auburn.
And I got to host that show with Chris and Patrick, so I asked them, how busy are you FFRF attorneys with complaints about religion in the schools?
For the legal team, it's probably more than half of the work that we're doing is, in some sense, working to protect public school students from religious pressures, religious coercion. This issue, I guess, that we're talking about today more so deals with the college environment, where I think college students have a lot more freedom, a lot less susceptible to coercion, but not in the context of sports. I think certainly that's an issue still of concern.
So, Chris, tell us about this Unite Auburn event and why FFRF has gotten involved.
Yeah. A couple weeks ago, we actually, before the event took place, we did receive a complaint that Hugh Freeze, that's Auburn's football coach, Bruce Pearl, their basketball coach, and Butch Thompson, their baseball coach, the holy trinity of coaches at Auburn, were involved in promoting a religious worship service that was going to take place on September 12th called Unite Auburn, dedicated to worship and giving messages to Auburn students seeking to grow their faith in God. The goal of the event was to unite the Christian community of Auburn under one roof to worship God. So it was concerning these coaches were promoting the event, but we weren't actually able to get to it before the event took place. But
you didn't have the gift of prophecy? No.
No, but actually now it's come up, and now we've received dozens of complaints, and it's just going viral what happened after the event. And we actually have a news clip here that will kind of set up what happened.
So you're going to have to tune in that on Facebook. It's archived on Facebook and on our YouTube channel to watch that clip. But Chris Line wrote a letter, and of course the pièce de résistance is that the head football coach, Hugh Freeze, baptized one of his athletic players at this event. And there was a lot more going on. So you can read more about it at our news release section or watch this show.
And you can watch it on FFRF's YouTube channel or look for the Ask an Atheist playlist on our webpage. A new episode airs almost every Wednesday at 12 noon Central on Facebook Live, on FFRF's Facebook page, where if you tune in live, you can ask questions during the show.
And on our TV show, Free Thought Matters, our guest this week, coming up on Sunday, is journalist Mary Jo McConaughey. She is a liberal Catholic journalist and author of the book Playing God, American Catholic Bishops and the Far Right, in which she describes how U.S. bishops are using dark money, I call it stained glass dark money, and they're aligned with ultra-right evangelists trying to force America to be a Christian nation. We don't hear that much about Catholics and Christian nationalism, but she is warning the nation about it.
And we asked Mary Jo McConaughey during the show why she was prompted to write a book that is so critical of the American bishops.
January 6th, like so many of us, I was watching in real time. I have lived through coups. I've reported on coups. And, you know, for a while, it looked as if it could go either way. And I saw crucifixes, symbols of Christianity, symbols that were dear to me growing up. And I was shocked. This is Christian nationalism. They are trying to upset the democratic system for their own purposes. And I saw Catholics speaking to the cameras. And I said, well, where do the bishops stand on all of this? And where are the bishops, by the way? In fact, two bishops, one of them a U.S. bishop, were giving forth the day before the Jericho March. This is Bishop Strickland. The point of the book is that so much that the bishops did over the years is what led to an atmosphere in which this kind of thing could happen, in which Catholics and Protestants and all kinds of faith-minded people felt free to participate, even though it was an anti-democratic effort.
You can watch that episode of Free Thought Matters right now on our YouTube channel. Look for the Free Thought Matters playlist.
And if you live in one of the major cities where Free Thought Matters is broadcast on local TV, you can watch it every Sunday morning. For stations and times, check ffrf.org/freethoughtmatters, or go to our webpage and look under the news dropdown.
So we have a number of strong victories for state church separation to report this week, but first a little national commentary, and I'm going to preface it by saying that just today there was an article in the New York Times about a new poll by Pew Research showing that among American adults under age 30, 70% favor having a national popular vote for the president and other things like that. But what's of most interest to us is that 58% favor expansion of the Supreme Court. It's been looked at as a very controversial issue, but that is huge support from the Gen Z generation. And we did some commentary this week about how Christian nationalists in public office are boosting COVID by demonizing boosters. And we've been documenting this since the COVID pandemic, but Governor DeSantis of Florida announced that he's not going to let public health entities use healthy Floridians as guinea pigs for new booster shots that have not been proven to be safe or effective, encouraging all Floridians under 65 to forego the booster, which is reckless public policy. And in fact, he's happily using healthy Floridians as guinea pigs for long COVID. And so you can read more about that.
So, Annie Laurie, why do you and I have sore arms today?
Exactly. We are encouraging everyone to go out, to trust in science, God, and get your COVID and your flu vaccines for that matter. We don't want the twindemic. And we did that last night. And my arm's a little swollen, but that's about it.
Now over to Virginia.
Well, we are also deploring a Governor Youngkin of Virginia for pardoning a violent disruptor who is a transphobe, and it's a very complicated situation involving basically a lie that it was a cause celebre for the anti-trans people claiming that a young girl had been raped by a transgender person in a bathroom. And you can read more about that.
He's very religious. He says God called him to run for governor.
That's right. You can read more about that at our website too. And then, don't we have some great victories?
We have a string of victories for the separation of church and state around the nation, including two very major successes that are getting a lot of media coverage. First, go ahead. We're applauding a California county for rescinding a motion to declare every July American Christian History Month.
That just happened this week that they voted to rescind it. And the Freedom From Religion Foundation had protested it, and also the community at large, many people. There was a petition, Jewish group. But the county seat is in Placerville, California, and they had voted in, I guess, July to make every July Christian History Month, excluding those of us who are not Christian and distorting. It was a resolution with all kinds of distortions. And there was only one person who voted against it. And
the first vote.
The first vote, Lori Parlin. And there was so much outrage that the county did the right thing and unanimously this week rescinded the proclamation. And we are really grateful to these people for listening. You know, it might have been just a knee-jerk thing. They didn't really think it through. They didn't really read it. And when they considered the implications of really basically declaring the county to be for Christians or that Christian history was more important, they got it and they rescinded it. And they deserve a lot of thanks.
And another victory over in Minnesota. We are cheering a Minnesota student and the school district for moving the graduation from a church. Minnesota's Eastern Carver County Schools was holding graduation in Grace Church in Eden Prairie. And a student named Eli Frost and other students complained about that because that church is very discriminatory against gay rights and other students' rights. And so we wrote them a letter, and they decided that they didn't want to risk litigation and that they're going to move that.
Yes, they voted on that last week, and 10 days ago, and they cited the Freedom from Religion Foundation's letter. And we also want to point out that Eli Frost, who's now a junior, had done a petition and with friends had done a great deal of protesting, some picketing at the last graduation in May. And this church is a mega church that also says that women who are the victims of domestic violence shouldn't be allowed to be divorced. So really inappropriate to end 13 years of secular public education in a sectarian church. Even if it was a liberal church, this is still an insult. But they've done the right thing, and now we're working on another district in the area to do the right thing.
Now, over in Victor Valley, California, there was a weird poster in the girls' bathroom at Victor Valley Union High School. The poster said, "Wash your hands and say your prayers because Jesus and germs are everywhere."
Which is very inadvertently funny, comparing Jesus to germs.
And a girl went into there and said, "What in the heck is this?" And she was confused about it and complained about it. So we wrote a letter complaining and asking them to remove it, and the district was very responsive and receptive. They wrote back saying, "The content referenced in your communication has been removed as of Monday, August 28th.
Well, so. I should think so. And another victory, the Freedom from Religion Foundation, with the help of our staff attorneys, got Bible quotes removed from Oklahoma classrooms, and Shia took public schools removed a number of Christian displays after we alerted them to these constitutional violations. And one of them was quoting John 3:16, a very large display. You know, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only son, whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life," and other such displays. And Chris Line, our staff attorney, wrote the superintendent, and she saw the light. And
Superintendent Bush wrote us back saying, "The items mentioned in your letter have been removed from the classroom."
And one has to assume superintendents often do not know details like this in a particular school, so it pays to complain.
So we're going to take a break, but stay tuned. After the break, we'll hear about what FFRF's Action Fund, that's our action group,
our legislative arm,
what they're doing. And then we're going to speak with Robert P. Jones, author of the book, The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy. Here's a little bit of George Gershwin, "Our Love is Here to Stay."
I'm an atheist and former Catholic. I even wrote a play about it called Letting Go of God. Right now, Catholic bishops are using their considerable influence to deny women contraceptive rights. Please join the Freedom from Religion Foundation and help keep church and state separate. You can call 1-800-335-4021, that's 1-800-335-4021, or visit ffrf.org to stand up for true religious freedom.
Speaking freely, thinking freely. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker. And the Freedom From Religion Foundation has a 501c4 advocacy branch called the FFRF Action Fund.
And it's been very busy, especially this week, issuing a lot of statements, monitoring a lot of things, including three menacing Christian nationalist political meetups last weekend or last week. And the first one is the National Association of Christian Lawmakers, and this is put together by Jason Rapart, who's a former Arkansas state lawmaker who started the group, and he's the guy that plopped the Ten Commandments on the Arkansas State House that FFRF is suing over, by the way. And at this Virginia event, he disgracefully showed off an Appeal to Heaven flag, which is known for its prominence at the January 6th Capitol attack, and he called to return America to its so-called Judeo-Christian origins. And they have proposed 15 pieces of model legislation. A lot of them are anti-abortion. They make lawmakers who join them sign a pledge that they oppose same-sex marriage, believe life begins at conception, and essentially endorse America being a Christian nation. And they mean business. And we pointed out they are missing the mark because 29% of the adult population today has no religion, and here they are promoting Christian nationalism. And then, no sooner was that over with, than we had a meeting by the Vote, it's called Pray, Vote, Stand Summit in D.C. It was put on by the Radical Extremist Family Research Council, also the Concerned Women for America legislative arm. And they want to promote biblical values and constitutional principles. And they had the Republican presidential primary front runners come and speak to them. And Trump was their keynote. And among the variety of things that were said was Pence, former Vice President Pence, repeated his very shopworn vow that he's a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican in that order. And I guess that we want listeners to realize that Christian nationalism is overtaking some political parties. This is for real. It's very scary. Pay attention.
And as Annie and Laurie told you, Donald Trump spoke at that Pray, Vote, Stand Christian Summit in D.C. last weekend. Listen to what he said about atheists, repeating apparently his new favorite line.
But I wanted to and had to stand up to the communists, the Marxists, the atheists, and the evil and demonic forces that want to destroy our country. I'm protecting the people of this nation.
So Donald Trump really believes in evil demons? Our country doesn't need to be protected from atheists. We need to honor atheists as a respected community in a diverse nation.
And then, Dan, you can tell us about some more antics. Well, we all saw that Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton was acquitted, and he is a Christian nationalist. And the reason that the Action Fund called attention to this is that it does mean extremists will be in charge of, if not the whole legislature, at least the House.
In Texas.
And they are ready. They're trying to pass a major voucher bill that has been defeated in the past. Of course, they're looking to put Ten Commandments in every classroom. So this doesn't augur anything good for the separation of state and church. And also, if you go to our Action Fund website, and you can read our release, and it does go into some of the hypocrisy of this person who has gone to incredible lengths to hide his extramarital affair from his wife while pandering to his base and pretending to be more pious than thou. So pay attention to that. And then also U.S. Senator Tuberville, he is somebody that has been very influential in Auburn University, bringing religion, as we talked about in the first segment, to almost every level of athletics at this public university. Mm-hmm. And we made a comment about how he is holding up all of the nominations for our military. He is endangering national security because we can't replace three-star generals. They did finally five votes after we issued this. There were five Republicans who did decide they would seat the chief of staff that had been held up for months and months. But he's holding up hundreds and hundreds of promotions and replacements because the military gives access to military service people if they are in an anti-abortion state. They make sure that they have the right to travel someplace else and up to and control their own reproduction. And that is why one zealot has been endangering national security, one very dangerous zealot.
But the defense secretary is not backing down from that.
No.
Lloyd Austin is saying a service member in Alabama deserves to have the same access to health care as a member in California or one stationed in Korea.
And they're both from Alabama, by the way.
Yeah.
And then we also issued a very important statement warning people about Project 2025, which is a right-wing collaboration where they want to establish in the first 180 days of the next presidency an autocracy, and basically PBS says replace it with Trump's vision, take a wrecking ball to the administrative state, and it does a whole lot of very dangerous things, taking away independence from the Justice Department, for example. It would harm environmentalism, but this statement goes into the harm to students and separation of church and state because, of course, this has been convened and funded by the Christian Nationalist Heritage Foundation. $22 million budget, so watch out.
So we're going to take a break. Here's a little bit of George Gershwin's Summertime. And after the break, we're going to be speaking with the distinguished Robert P. Jones. He's author of the new book, The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future. We'll be right back with more Free Thought Radio.
Member of FFRS and promoter of Real Wellness Lifestyles. I'm no longer willing to say, in God I trust, so help me God, God bless America, or pretend America is more under a God than any other nation. Join the resistance to Christian nationalism and politicians more attentive to what they think God wants than the needs of their constituents. Let's make separation of church and state a reality and turn back the drift to theocracy. Support FFRF. Our freedom really does depend on freethinkers.
Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we're back with the interview portion of Free Thought Radio, and we've really been looking forward to our guest today.
And I'm Dan Barker. Is white Christian America coming to an end? If so, how did it begin? Our guest today has some powerful answers about the hidden roots of white supremacy. Robert P. Jones is the founder and president of PRRI, the Public Religion Research Institute. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan group that conducts independent research about the intersection of religion, culture, and public policy. With a PhD in religion from Emory University, Jones writes regularly on politics, on culture, and religion for many magazines, The Atlantic, Time, Religion News Service, and other outlets. He's often featured in major national media. He's the author of a book called The End of White Christian America, which won the 2019 Graumeier Award in Religion.
And a few months ago, we spoke with Robert P. Jones on this show about another book of his, White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity, which won a 2021 American Book Award. His highly anticipated newest book, just out by Simon & Schuster, is called The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future. Welcome back to Free Thought Radio, Robbie.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
So we're talking to you from Mississippi today, I guess, right? That's where you were born and raised.
That's right. It's my home state, and it is stop one on the book tour after the book's been released on September 5th. So down here doing six events at churches, at the Civil Rights Museum here in Jackson, and in three different cities.
And we are really looking forward to you showing up at our 46th annual convention on October 14th here in Madison.
I'm looking forward to it.
So I just finished, I read every word of your new book, The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy. And I have to say, this is one of the most powerful and most moving books I've ever read. There are a number of really good books on white Christian nationalism, but this one I think is just a grade above all the others.
Well, that's so kind, and high praise coming from you. So I really appreciate it. I did aim in this book for it to be, you know, it's a very difficult topic, racial violence in the country toward both indigenous people and African Americans at the hands of, my people, good white Christian people. And so it's a difficult topic. But I did try to make it readable and accessible. So I'm pleased to hear that I may have succeeded at least in that part of it.
Well, you have one part on Emmett Till, another on Duluth lynchings in the 20s, and then, of course, the Tulsa Race Massacre. But first, we've heard a lot about the important 1619 Project, but you're saying that the year 1493 was at least, if not more important than 1619, as important in regards to the establishment of white supremacy in America. And why is that?
Well, I'll start with the important and just want to say full stop that the 1619 Project was an important cultural watershed, really, in our history. And because it challenged this other idea, I mean, the other date, that you didn't say, but it's the one that everybody will just go to, is 1776, right? And so we had this kind of tug of war between 1776 and 1619 when the 1619 Project came out. President Trump immediately came out and announced his counselor project, the 1776 Project. Well, what's that about? And it's really about what's in the frame. So if you think about it like a snapshot of like what would go on in an American history textbook cover, is it a picture of just some white dudes either marching with their fifes and drums and, marching for liberty? Or is it the more refined, also white men gathered in Philadelphia in their colonial finery with their quill pens out about to sign a Declaration of Independence? As the 1619 Project challenged us, do we need to look back further in our history to really understand the dynamics? And is it a ship arriving with Africans there kidnapped and brought across the ocean against their will, destined for enslavement in Virginia in 1619 in the British colonies? And I think that was a really important shift. And what I'm arguing, I think, is for a kind of yes and approach to that wider view of American history. But if we only have 1619 in our view, we're actually missing more than a century of European contact with indigenous people in these lands. And that kind of prologue, even to 1619, is actually quite important to get there. So I was kind of looking for what you might call a kind of proximate cause to our current dilemmas in America. And they really, I landed on 1493. Now, that's not 1492. The year that Columbus sailed the ocean blue, as we learned in those kind of elementary school educational rhymes. But it's 1493. And so what happens that year is that he goes back after encountering peoples and lands here. And he goes back and he needs a few things. And he asks the king and queen of Spain for more ships, more soldiers, more missionaries for a voyage back for a kind of conquest and colonization voyage. But he also needs more than just a political mandate and support. He needs a moral mandate and support. And so who does he turn to for that? Well, he turns to the Christian church. And at that time, this is before, in the 1493, is before the Catholic-Protestant split. It's before the Church of England breaks from the Catholic Church. So there's a kind of unified religious authority in Western Europe, and that is the Pope in Rome. So that's who he appeals to. And there had been a body of work that came to be known as the Doctrine of Discovery, that really began developing as soon as Europeans made contact with people in the Americas. And the essential question was this, like, what rights did these people have that we are bound to respect? And the church came back with a pretty clear and resounding answer. And the criteria, the kind of theological logic, the moral logic behind these doctrines really hinged around one simple thing. Are they Christian? And if the answer to that was no, then they were to be considered, and this is the language from the document, they were to be considered enemies of Christ.
Wow.
And as enemies of Christ, it meant that they had permission from the church and the Christian princes of Europe to take the land, steal their goods, and if they resisted, to kill them. And then even this language, I mean, it was very explicit, didn't mince words at all. You know, the kind of stirring lines out of one of the earliest of these papal bulls that came out addressing this question, even said very explicitly, not only, you know, can you occupy, steal, and kill, but that, you know, you can and should reduce their persons to perpetual slavery. And so that's the version of Christianity that actually lands on the shores of these lands.
The first slavery on the continent, getting rid of the people who were on the land that the Lord told them to conquer, right?
Well, and Dan, you belong to the Delaware Lenape tribe, so this has to have meaning.
Our tribe supposedly sold Manhattan to the Dutch for $24. That never happened. But a whole bunch of tribes had to be migrated and pushed or killed or genocided. And your book, Robert, goes into a lot of detail about what happened in every single state. Every one of the states in this country had that history of genocide and dispossession,
yeah, that's right.
Didn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and so I picked three states in the book because a book has to have, you know, a limited number of pages. But you're exactly right. I mean, you could it wouldn't have mattered any state I picked. So I tell the story of my home state of Mississippi, also Oklahoma, because I wanted kind of a Western, and Oklahoma has its very particular history of, you know, being essentially a refugee dumping ground for people for indigenous people who were forcibly removed from all over the country and shuttled into what was originally called Indian Territory. And as that shrank and shrank and shrank, it was left of what we have today as the state of Oklahoma. But this is really an American story, you know, and so I also tell the story in a far north state in Minnesota. But yeah, you know, any of the 13 colonies, none of these lands become available for, you know, people of European descent to farm, to occupy without genocide, disease, deception, you know, broken treaties, promises made, promises very quickly broken, and just this kind of swath of violence and dispossession, all justified by this idea that European civilization and Christianity were superior to anything found on this continent.
So we're going to have to take a break, but when we come back, we're talking with Robert P. Jones about his amazing, very important new book about the hidden roots of white supremacy. And Robbie, this is personal for you. You talk in this book about growing up in the same area where Emmett Till was killed, murdered horribly, and never knowing about it till you got to college. So that's one of the things that you concentrate on this book. And when we come back, we want to talk to you all about that.
Hi, I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed, as you may be, by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective association of atheists and agnostics working to keep state and church separate, just like our founders intended. Please, join the Freedom From Religion Foundation today. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylord.
And welcome back. I'm Dan Barker, and we're continuing our conversation with Robert P. Jones, author of the new book, brand new book just out, called The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future. So, Robert, you write in the book, and you were telling us earlier that even though you grew up in Mississippi, not far from where the Emmett Till event happened, you didn't learn about this until when?
You know, it must have been at least college. I was certainly an adult by the time I really learned much about it. And, you know, I'll make it even closer. So I grew up in Jackson. That happened up in Tallahatchie County in the Delta, a couple hours away, not that far, but certainly, you know, within the bounds of my home state. And it was certainly an event that the world knew about, but didn't really make it into any curriculum that I got as a public. And I went to public school all the way through. But the other ones, maybe even more surprising than that, is, you know, I graduated, you know, from public school at the top of my class. And if you had asked me who Medgar Evers was, who lived 9 miles from me, who was gunned down in his driveway 9 miles from mine, I also wouldn't have known that history either.
Oh, wow.
So why is that? Why is this history being suppressed?
Well, you know, I think it's a fairly straightforward answer, is that, you know, it's a pretty brutal history of racial violence. And, you know, what's notable about Medgar Evers, and it's wrapped up with Christianity. So there's a defense of religion, a defense of whiteness, that's built into these historical denials, cover-ups, and, you know, willful amnesia. And, you know, so it's worth noting that, like, with Medgar Evers, for example, he, you know, was, if you ask what he was doing, the last organizing he was doing was he was trying to integrate the churches in Jackson, Mississippi, First Baptist Church and Galloway Memorial Methodist Church downtown, right down by the state capitol. And that's what he was organizing to do. And who was he murdered by? Byron Day LeBeckwith, who was an Episcopalian from the Delta, who was a member in good standing at Church of the Nativity up in the Delta, and who had written letters to the editor saying if any black person tried to come to his church, he'd be waiting for them with a gun on the steps. And so if you really examine this history, you know, like I said, you know, this kind of attitude of hierarchy, white supremacy, and moral justification rooted in this idea of the supremacy of Christianity and European civilization runs through all of it, and is Jim Crow, slavery, all of it justified by a Southern version of Christianity. And I think it's just an unwillingness to really want to take that clear testimony of history seriously today.
You write in your book, Christianity as practiced by white Mississippians has proven to be more pliant than principled. It's been too often anchored in a self-serving emotional experience that is untethered from morality and justice. So you're from that religious tradition. How does it make you feel to learn all of this personally?
Yeah, it was shocking. So I grew up Southern Baptist here in Jackson, Mississippi, and you know, never got the truth really about this legacy of the tradition I inherited. So it's been really, I appreciate you talking about, you know, the last three books. It's been now a decade and three books that I've written trying to sort out, you know, essentially this entanglement of white supremacy and Christianity in the American context. And, you know, to your point there and that quote, it reminds me again of, you know, this thing that Martin Luther King Jr. said about white Christians, and here he was criticizing not just the overt racists, but the so-called moderates. And he, in a letter from Birmingham jail, he has this searing passage where he's just like, who are these people sitting safely behind the anesthetizing power of stained glass windows, right? And that religion soothed racist consciousness instead of enlivening them. And I think that's just such a tragedy, and again, a kind of clear history of the way that Christianity, particularly in the South, but not only in the South. I mean, this is one thing that the book makes clear, that it's not really a Southern problem. It's not a conservative problem. It's really an American problem. And this clear choice that we have always had, and the thing about being less principled and more pliant when it comes to democracy, is one of the things I hope the book is making clear is that we've had these two competing traditions, and we have had them since before the founding of the Republic, and it's this. It's essentially a question of who the country is and who it's for. Are we a kind of promised land for European Christians, or are we a pluralistic democracy where everybody, regardless of race or religion or no religion, stands on equal footing before the Constitution and the law? And we have never honestly answered that question, and I think we're still wrestling with it today.
Well, it's certainly coming to the forefront with the Christian nationalism overtaking certain parties.
Mm-hmm. So didn't the Pope come over and apologize?
Well, he did. So I write about this in the book, that Pope Francis came over this past year, actually, and he went on what he called a penitential pilgrimage. It was largely in Canada, visited many indigenous boarding schools where people had been forcibly send their children to really horrific treatment. And that story is just beginning to come out. It's been some great scholarship, but the kind of public conversation is just barely starting to happen and the reckoning there. But he did issue a kind of apology, where he did say that, to the extent that anything, any doctrines that imply superiority, of one people over the other, those are wrong. But he never quite embraced the fact that the church itself had made these pronouncements. So he says some things like, to the extent that there were people who did this in Christ's name, we apologize. To the extent that there were Christian princes who did this claiming the authority of the church, we apologize. But he never really said what is the truth, and that is that the church itself put these doctrines forward. His predecessors in the Vatican put these forward. And one way I've kind of summed it up, there's a lot of technical language in the document that he did release in the Vatican that often gets billed as an apology or repudiation. I think it does fall a little short of that. One way I've characterized this is that, if I had done something wrong to my spouse and that was the apology I issued, we'd still be talking.
Wow.
Now, we want to save time, just a few minutes left, about how you feel this question that illuminates the path forward. How can we meaningfully respond to being beneficiaries of a crime so plain it cannot be denied and so large it can never be fully righted?
Yeah, it's an enormous question before us. And we're talking at centuries of how the country was founded and what happens when Europeans come to this continent, their treatment of indigenous people, their treatment of African people. It's centuries old, and it's a huge thing to get our heads around. But the book does have some hopeful notes on it. But I do think it's going to require, first and foremost, something we seem to be unable to clearly do, and that is to tell the truth about how we got here. Right. Racial strife, racial inequality, horrific treatment of indigenous people, and all of that's been largely swept to the margins of our public stories that we tell about ourselves, at least people who look like me and with my background, and that we put in our public school textbooks. And so I think really, again, I think we're at the very beginning of this process. It's going to take generations to undo. But I think the work that's most immediately in front of us is simply to tell the truth and to tell the whole truth. I come out of that Christian tradition that has, Jesus saying, you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. And I think we've often used that as a kind of platitude in our churches. But I think we're coming to realize that, actually that kind of truth with the history we've had is going to first and foremost require an honest look in the mirror and a really sincere set of confessions that are going to, if we're going to find any way of finding a shared path forward.
And I like how you point out euphemisms are used, explorer, pioneer, homesteader, that you say create a respectable veneer instead of using words like invader, occupier, colonizer. Just even that change would be very meaningful.
So
that's right. And we've got, we have a holiday coming up where this is all going to be, right in front of us, right, with this holiday that officially is called Columbus Day,
right?
That alternatively celebrated as Indigenous Peoples Day. We just had Biden was the first president to actually, make a proclamation around Indigenous people in people's day. And, you know, it's really a troubling holiday, celebrating, you know, the person who set us on this course of justified in the name of violence, occupation, colonization, all justified by this version of European Christianity.
Well, thank you.
And who, by the way, never set foot on any that we call the United States of America. Yeah.
Well, we're out of time, Robert P. Jones. There's so much more we could talk about. The book is called The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future.
It's available from fffrf.org/shop, or you can come and get an autographed copy at our national convention.
Thank you for being with us today, Robert.
Oh, thank you so much. Happy to be here.
And thank you, listeners, to tuning in to WOOM in Philadelphia, to WZML in Bryn Mawr, to WIDE and WMUU in Madison, Wisconsin, to WADR in Janesville, KEOS in Bryan, Texas, KZSM in San Marcos, Texas, KOPN in Columbia, Missouri, KEPW in Eugene, Oregon, WOOL in Bellows Falls, Vermont, WRIU in Kingston, Rhode Island, WRFI in Ithaca, Watkins Glen, New York. And if you're listening on the podcast, give us a thumbs up. Tell friends and family how to contact and learn more about Free Thought Radio at fffrf.org/radio.
And learn more about the Freedom from Religion Foundation at fffrf.org, where you can ask for information or join us in our critical work as the National State Church watchdog and the largest Free Thought Association in North America. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday you'll join us and the world will live as one.
And before we do our makeup episode of TUC Radio, a reminder for tomorrow at noon.
This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour, every Saturday, 12 p.m., where we broadcast the news that you won't find on cable. Ever wonder what Gen Z is up to? Have you heard of Generation U? Ever wonder why the old geezers are excited that something's going on since their days of living underground and avoiding the Vietnam draft? We cover these topics on the Abolitionist Hour, and we kind of give you updates on the front, whether it's Atlanta, Minneapolis, St. Louis, Kansas City. We'll keep you updated on news and information on the state of dismal prison conditions and why the Jackson County Jail is not just a stockade, it's a phone company. So join us at the Abolitionist Hour, only on Blog Talk Radio, 12 p.m. Central Standard Time. We'll see you there.
And from the plains of Royal Mead, drunk men came hurrying through. Well, Britannia's Huns with her long-range guns came in through the foggy tears. Back to the glen I rode again, and my heart with grief was sore. For I parted them with valiant whom I never shall see more.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Slow Motion Execution of Julian Assange. Chris Hedges in conversation with Craig Murray. Chris Hedges is the former Middle East Bureau Chief of the New York Times, a Pulitzer Prize winner, and acclaimed author. Thanks to the Real News Network for broadcasting this conversation with Craig Murray on September 15, 2023. That's a date of great importance, as the extradition of Julian Assange from Great Britain to the U.S. might be only weeks away. Ambassador Craig Murray gives a brief overview of the legal battle and miscarriage of justice.
They're claiming that Julian is under their jurisdiction because he published American secrets, even though he's not an American and he wasn't in America. And at the same time, while they claim jurisdiction over him, they're claiming he has no First Amendment rights because he's an Australian.
Craig Murray, the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, was removed from his post after he made public the widespread use of torture by the Uzbek government and the CIA. He has since become one of Britain's most important human rights campaigners and a fierce advocate for Julian Assange, as well as a supporter of Scottish independence. His coverage of the trial of former Scottish First Minister Alex Salmond, who was acquitted of sexual assault charges, saw him charged with contempt of court and sentenced to 8 months in prison. The very dubious sentence, half of which Craig served, upended most legal norms. He was sentenced, his supporters argued, to prevent him from testifying as a witness in the Spanish criminal case against UC Global Director David Morales being prosecuted for installing a surveillance system in the Ecuadorian embassy when Julian Assange found refuge that was used to record the privileged communications between Julian and his lawyers. Morales is alleged to have carried out this surveillance on behalf of the CIA. Murray has published some of the most prescient and eloquent reports from Julian's extradition hearings and was one of a half dozen guests, including myself, invited to Julian and Stella's wedding in Belmarsh Prison in March 2022. Joining me to discuss what is happening to Julian Assange and the rapid erosion of our most basic democratic rights is Craig Murray. And just to begin, Craig, I read all of your reports from the trial, which are at once eloquent and brilliant. I think it's the best coverage or the hearings that we've had of the hearings. But I want you to bring us up to date where we are with the case at this moment.
Yeah. The legal procedures have been extraordinarily convoluted. After the first hearings, the magistrate ruled that Julian couldn't be extradited on essentially health grounds and due to the conditions in American prisons. The United States appealed against that verdict and the High Court accepted the United States appeal on extraordinarily dubious grounds based on a diplomatic note giving certain assurances which were conditional and based on Julian's future behavior. And of course, the United States government has a record of breaking such assurances. And also, those assurances could have been given at the time of the initial hearing and weren't.
And I don't think those assurances have any, it was a diplomatic note, it has no legal validity.
It has no legal validity. It's not binding in any sense. And as I say, it is in itself conditional. It states that they may change this in future. It actually says that
Based on his behavior.
Based on his behavior, which they will be the sole judges of, you know, and which won't involve any further legal process. They will just decide he's going into a supermax because they don't like the way he looks at guards or something. You know, it's utterly meaningless. And as I say, the United States having won that appeal, so Julian could be extradited, it was then Julian's turn to appeal on all the points he had lost at the original extradition. And those include the First Amendment, include freedom of speech, obviously. They include the fact that the very extradition treaty under which he's being extradited states that there shall be no political extradition. And this is plainly a very political case. And several other important grounds. Nothing then happened for a year. And that appeal is an extraordinary document. You can actually find it on my website, craigmurray.org.uk. I've published the entire appeal document, and it is an amazing document. It's an incredible piece of legal argument. And some of the things it sets out, like the fact that the United States' key witness for the charges was an Icelandic guy who they paid for his evidence. They paid him for his evidence. And he is a convicted pedophile and convicted fraudster. And since he has said he lied in his evidence and he just did it for the money. That's just one example of the kind of things you find. The documentation is not dry legal documentation at all. It's well worth going and looking through Julian's appeal. That appeal ran to, I think, 150 pages plus supporting documents. For a year, nothing happened. Then 2 or 3 months ago, it was dismissed in 3 pages of double-spaced A4, in which the judge, Judge Swift, said that there were no legal arguments, no coherent legal arguments in this 150 pages, and it followed no norm, for no known form of pleading, and it was dismissed completely. The thing is that the appeal was written by some of the greatest lawyers in the world. You know, it's supervised and written by Gareth Pearce, who is, I would say, is the greatest living human rights lawyer. Those people have seen the film In the Name of the Father, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. Gareth is the lawyer, and she's played in the film by Emma Thompson. She is the lawyer who got out all those people who were framed by the British government for being members of the Irish Republican Army and terrorists, and they weren't. They were all framed. It was Gareth who got them out. She's won numerous high-profile cases. She has enormous respect all around the world. And this judge, who is nobody, is saying there's no validity to her pleadings, which follow no known form of pleading. And this is quite extraordinary.
And am I correct in that he was a barrister essentially for the defense ministry? He served the interests of the UK government, and that's essentially got him his position. Is that correct?
Exactly. He was the lead barrister for the security services. Well, he was a barrister who specialized in working for the security services, and he's on record as stating that the security services were his favorite clients because they are, you know, organized and brilliant and cogent, and he's entirely a tool of the security services, and that's why he was given this particular job. Now, this is all quite extraordinary. There's almost no pretense of due process involved here, but that's been true throughout the proceedings. One of the things I witnessed during the initial extradition hearings was that when procedural motions were made, for example, on whether certain evidence was admissible, the defense would stand up and argue why the evidence should be admissible, and then the prosecution would stand up and argue why the evidence should not be admissible. And then the judge would give her ruling. But the judge came into court, and the public gallery is seated above the judge. You're higher than the judge. You can look down on the judge. And I saw 100% for certain the judge came into court with her ruling already typed out before she heard the arguments. She sat there almost pretending to listen to what the defense was saying for an hour and what the prosecution was saying for an hour. Then she simply read out the ruling.
She's like the Queen of Hearts. It was in Alice in Wonderland, you know, giving the verdict before she hears the sentence.
Precisely that. And my own strong suspicion is it's not the judge who wrote that ruling.
Right.
That's what she was given, you know, as this is what we want as a ruling on this
one. And just before we go on, I mean, you and I have covered, you've covered it more extensively than I have, but I've covered it and have been in London for some of the hearings. On the most basic level, the evisceration of attorney-client privilege, because UC Global recorded the meetings between Julian and his lawyers, that in a UK court, as in a US court, alone should get the trial invalidated.
Yeah, in any democracy in the world, if your intelligence services have been recording the client's attorney consultations, that would get the case thrown out. What the Americans are claiming, what the Americans claimed in court and the British government and the British judge accepted, was that the CIA, having recorded all this material, did nothing with it. They didn't give it to anybody. They did not give it to the Justice Department, that nobody else in the American government saw it. I mean, if that were true, I should say I don't believe it for a moment, but if I were an American taxpayer, I would want to know why is the CIA going to enormous lengths and spending loads of money to obtain secret recordings of and then do nothing with them. How can that be true? It makes absolutely no sense, and any judge would laugh that out. It's like me saying that, you know, I did rob the bank around the corner, but I wasn't going to spend the money. I was just keeping it in the cupboard, so that's okay. It's completely ludicrous. And the fact that was accepted, you know, it's one of many just extraordinary rulings in this case. And it hurt me, to be honest. I had some belief in judicial system. I had some belief that in Western democracies there is due process and there's a certain amount of fairness. I now don't believe that at all. I've absolutely completely come to the conclusion that it's a charade and a fake, and that powers behind the scenes dictate what happens in major cases in the justice system. And,
well, you had 3 months in jail, I guess, to get that point driven onto you.
To get used to it. Yeah.
But this is the last within the UK legal system, this appeal, which, as I understand, was 3 months ago. Wasn't there a 6-week deadline where they had to render a ruling within 6 weeks?
The defense had 6 weeks to submit their 20-page. And the understanding was that, you know, that meant that the thing would be done very quickly. But it's all terribly arbitrary. You know, after the first appeal was submitted, there was over a year's gap for no reason at all. And then just a 3-page response to it. You know, it doesn't take a year to write a 3-page response. And so at times it seems as though the process is for punishment. I mean, they're quite happy that they've got Julian in a maximum security prison in dreadful positions, and they're slowly killing him, in effect. And so they are in no hurry. And at times it seems as though they're deliberately doing things as slowly as possible.
Well, this is what Niels Melzer, the special rapporteur on torture for the UN, said, that he called it a slow motion execution, I think were his words.
And as you know, they put me in jail, and my own belief is that wasn't anything to do with the articles I'd published on the trial of Alex Salmond. That was just the excuse.
Of course.
Because of my advocacy for and friendship with Julian. That's why they put me in jail, I think. And that I was in the cell. My cell was 12 feet by 8 feet, which is slightly larger than Julian's cell. And I was kept in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day, sometimes 23 and a half hours a day, for 4 months. And that's extremely difficult. It's extremely difficult. But I knew when I was leaving. You know, yeah. I had an end date. To be in those kind of conditions as Julian is, and having for years and years, and no idea if it will ever stop. No idea if you will ever be let out alive, let alone not having an end date. I just can't imagine, you know, how psychologically crushing that would be.
Well, we heard some very disturbing testimony at the hearing about his psychological state, which, to her credit, Baritzer took into the judge.
She did.
Took into account, but calling the suicide hotline and hallucinating and banging his head against the wall. I mean, he's been 4 years now, is it, in this high security prison in London at Belmarsh, and then 7 years in the embassy.
It's amazing this is happening. You know, he's a publisher.
I know.
For goodness sake. He's not even a whistleblower.
I know. Unlike Ellsberg, people forget. Ellsberg took the documents.
Yeah.
Exactly. Julian published them.
Yeah.
He didn't take them.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And when I myself blew the whistle, the Financial Times published the information.
This is on the black sites.
On black sites, an extraordinary rendition, yeah. I was fully expecting to go to jail at that stage. I thought, you know, I'm a whistleblower. I've done this for moral reasons. I'm prepared to go to jail for it. You know, I think we've got to stop this extraordinary rendition program. That means me going to jail. I'm prepared to take that. I'd have been astonished if they'd locked up the editor of the Financial Times for publishing the information. That's not how the system works. It's the whistleblower who takes the moral responsibility. This is a publisher, and you're locking him up with literally the worst terrorists in Europe who are kept in that maximum security establishment. Why? It's quite extraordinary. Look at me. I'm an old bloke who writes, and I was kept in solitary confinement for 4 months. why? Yeah, well, what? Why do I need? Why does Julian need? Why are we such a danger that you have to be kept in the same conditions as serial killers?
Well, because you're exposing truths, very inconvenient truths about the reality of the systems that we live under, which you're right, it's a democratic facade, but it's not democratic anymore, like the late Roman Republic. I want to talk about, so once this two-panel hearing is over, and I think it's a pretty safe assumption that they will reject the appeal, what happens then?
The immediate thing that will happen is that Julian's lawyers will try to go to the European Court in Strasbourg to... European Court of Human Rights to submit an appeal and get the extradition stopped pending an appeal. The worry is that Julian would instantly be extradited, you know, that the government wouldn't wait to hear from the European Court.
Explain to Americans what it is and what jurisdiction it has in the UK, the European Court.
Yeah. The European Court of Human Rights is not a European Union body. It's a body of the Council of Europe. And it has jurisdiction over the European Convention of Human Rights, which guarantees basic human rights. And therefore, it has legally binding jurisdiction over human rights violations in any member state of the treaty. So it does have a legally binding jurisdiction and is acknowledged as such normally by the UK government. They're very powerful voices within the current Conservative government in the UK, which wants to exit the Convention on Human Rights. But at present, that's not the case. The UK is still part of this system. And so the European Court of Human Rights has legally binding authority over the government of the United Kingdom, purely on matters that contravene human rights.
And if they do extradite him, I mean, they've essentially nullified that process. I mean, the fear is that, of course, the security services would know about the ruling in advance. He'd be on the tarmac and shuttled it, you know, sedated and put in a diaper and hooded or something and put out a CIA flight to Washington. I want to talk about if that happens. I think it's certainly very possible. What we need to do here, and I know part of the reason you're in the United States is to prepare for that should it take place. I think you will try and cover the hearings trial here as you did in the UK. But let's talk about where we go if that...
Well, I think the first thing to say is that if that happens, on the day it happens, it will be the biggest news story in the world. It will be a massive news story. So we have to be prepared. We have to know who from the Assange movement or who from his defense team, who's going to be the spokesman, who are going to be the spokespeople, who are going to be offered up to all the major news agencies, because we have to affect the story on day one. Because if you get behind the story and we know what their line will be, they'll put out all these lies about people being killed because of WikiLeaks, about the American security being endangered. We know all the propaganda that they will try to flood the airwaves with. So we need to be ready and ahead of the game to know who our people are, who are going to be offered up to interview, who are going to proactively get onto the media, and not just the alternative media like this media, but onto the mainstream media as well, so-called mainstream, and get out the story. So those things have to be taken. And then there are all the practical things, you know, the many on Julian's family, which will need to come over to support him. We'll need to know immediately how to get them, where to get them to, what their accommodation is going to be. We need activists on that day to be ready to go out and start demonstrating all over the United States. And one thing that I really believe, I've been very on this tour I'm on in the States at the moment, I've been meeting activists, and there's a huge base of very experienced and extremely impressive activists who are interested in the Assange case. But there's no real spark to it yet. I think the day he arrives, and you will have the Deadwood press, like the Washington Post and the New York Times, will be running editorials saying this shouldn't be happening. So there will be much more public awareness of what's happening and what's behind it. And I think that day there are a lot of people ready to jump into action. Well, they have to know what to do. We have to know in each city and town in the United States where there's going to be a demonstration the day he arrives, where people should go, what time they should get there. You know, all we need to start preparing that kind of base level of activism.
I visited Julian with my friend Michael Ratner, who was Julian's lawyer since we've lost Michael a couple of years ago. But I remember, my great civil rights attorney, founded the Center for Constitutional Rights. But I remember Michael telling me that in order to prosecute these cases, and he got legal representation, for instance, for the prisoners in Guantanamo, you need people in the streets, that it's extremely important. And he's talking about his work in the courtroom, that there are people outside the courtroom, and you may have been in the courtroom when I was in London with Baritza complaining at one point, the judge, about the noise. Outside the courtroom.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. We're going to need to have people at the actual court itself. And there'll be all kinds of procedural steps of Julian being produced and not produced and all kinds of motions filed and things before the court itself gets the trial proper, gets going. But at each stage, it's very important to have people available and at the courtroom and able to go outside.
What about the argument that Biden doesn't want to deal with this? Well, he's a very close election. He's kind of neck and neck with Trump. And then let's also talk about the speculation that there might be a plea deal and he could go to Australia. He's an Australian citizen, of course.
Firstly, I sometimes really wonder whether the United States government realizes how it looks to the outside world. You know, here you have a government whose main political opponent, and I'm no fan of Donald Trump, I'm not a fan of Donald Trump, but he is their main political opponent, and they're trying to put him in prison so he can't fight in an election. Now, how does that look to the rest of the world? What are you constantly accusing Russia of doing? What are you constantly accusing all kinds of other nations of doing? You know, how does that affect U.S. standing? We've got a presidential election coming, so the guy who's ahead in the polls, let's put him in jail so he can't stand. You know, that's... And if at the same time you're doing that, you're also trying to put the most famous publisher in the world in jail simultaneously, what message is that sending out to the world? You know, that's sending out the message to the world that you are a completely fake democracy and that your human rights record is actually no better than that of China or Russia or any of these other countries you are constantly criticizing. So I think the Biden administration would be completely mad to bring Julian here to extradite Julian. You know, I don't understand why they don't see the danger in what they are doing in terms of freedom of speech worldwide and people's opinion to repression and censorship worldwide.
I think because it's driven by the CIA. I think the CIA with Vault 7, which exposed the hacking tools that the CIA has put into our phones, our televisions, even our cars. And that, of course, is when Trump announced the extradition, and before President Obama had used the Espionage Act against whistleblowers, but he hadn't used it against journalists. Trump upped the ante by calling for the use of the Espionage Act to extradite, in this sense, a journalist. But my reading of it is that it they don't care how they look, and part of it is to send a message. It doesn't matter what nationality you are. It doesn't matter where you are. WikiLeaks is not a U.S.-based publication. Doesn't matter where you are. If you expose the kind of information that Julian and WikiLeaks exposed, we're going to come for you. Isn't that the message?
I think that's absolutely right. And this, again, it's amazing they don't see the dangers in this claim of universal jurisdiction. The United States isn't going to be the most powerful country in the world for much longer. It arguably it already isn't. But you know, China is growing stronger and stronger. What are they going to say when the Chinese start plucking away American journalists for having published something rude about China, even though they've never been to China? You know, and this claim of universal jurisdiction is extraordinary. And what's even more extraordinary is they're claiming universal jurisdiction, that Julian is under their jurisdiction because he published American secrets, even though he's not an American and he wasn't in America. And at the same time, while they claim jurisdiction over him, they're claiming he has no First Amendment rights because he's an Australian. Now, that's an extraordinary, the combination of that. Okay, we have jurisdiction over you. You have all the liabilities that come with that, but you have none of the rights that come with that because you're not one of our citizens. That, you know, that's pernicious. it's so illogical and so vicious. I actually didn't believe it. I thought this was just Pompeo mouthing off until there was a recent Supreme Court judgment about 2 years ago in the case of U.S. aid against overseas development agencies, where it said essentially that the people abroad in receipt of U.S. aid don't have First Amendment rights and can be gagged from saying certain things as a condition of aid because they're not U.S. citizens. And if you read the judgment specifically says we cannot accord First Amendment rights to non-U.S. citizens because otherwise it would have to apply to overseas citizens handled by the U.S. military. So what they're saying is if Julian has First Amendment rights, then people in Guantanamo Bay have rights. So no one has
I just
rights.
Want to close because there's been noises out of Australia. The ambassador, Carolyn Kennedy, said that they might consider a plea deal. I have put no credence in it. I think it's all smoke, but I wondered what you thought.
Yeah, I think it's an attempt to placate Australian public opinion. Public opinion in Australia is extremely strong. You know, over 80% of Australians want Julian released and allowed to go home to Australia. And Blinken came there and made some very hostile and undiplomatic remarks at a time Australia was allowing the United States to base nuclear weapons on its side. So I think Caroline Kennedy came out of this. I think it's a lie, frankly. There has been no approach from the Justice Department or from the State Department offering any kind of plea deal. It's purely smoke and mirrors to try to distract the Australian public. Caroline Kennedy was lying to the Australian public. That's pure and simple.
Great, thanks. That was Craig Murray, the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan and one of the great champions of Julian Assange. I want to thank the Real News Network and its production team, Cameron Granadino, Adam Coley, David Hebden, and Kayla Rivera. You can find me at chrishedges.substack.com.
And my thanks go out to all. Chris Hedges, former Middle East Bureau Chief for the New York Times and War Reporter, and acclaimed author, most recently of The Greatest Evil is War. Craig Murray was the British ambassador to Uzbekistan. He was removed from his post after he made public the use of torture by the Uzbek government and the CIA. He now is one of Britain's most important human rights campaigners. And many thanks to the Real News Network. You can find this conversation on YouTube under the title The Slow Motion Execution of Julian Assange. All need and deserve our attention and support. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelerden. Thank you for listening.